The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda and is intended for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. Please consult with professionals before making any healthcare decisions.
And like we were in the schools and the young folks came to us and was just like, yo, this is all cool and all, but like, can we talk about sexual harassment? And we're like, okay. Right. And this is before like the Me Too movement, before a lot of stuff became popularized. And they're just like, yo, we can't go anywhere without being yelled at, touched, all these things.
That voice belongs to Norbese Flint, the policy director and program manager for Black Women for Wellness. She joins Amy for a Believe 19 interview later in the show. And you'll also hear from pediatrician, four-star admiral, and the current assistant secretary for health, who also serves as senior advisor to HRSA and the CDC, director of the U.S. coronavirus diagnostic testing, and the U.S. representative on the World Health Organization's executive board. My, that's a lot of responsibility. Assistant secretary for health, Admiral Brett Gerwah. We'll also touch on the recent virtual insurance and reimbursement conference hosted by the National Hemophilia Foundation before diving into ICER's evidence report on therapies for hemophilia A. All that. Plus, do you have your 2021 calendar yet? I know there's a lot going on. You may have other priorities. I'm here to make sure your calendar's taken care of. If you don't, you're in luck. And I'll tell you why in just a moment. But before I do, I should say to you, hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch, joined as I am each week by none other than my colleague, friend, and co-host, Colorado native but LA's own, Amy Board. Hello, Amy. And before I ask you how you're doing, I should let listeners know that we are recording this at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday, November 3rd. You know, Election Day. Well before anything remotely useful has been learned about the vote. So for listeners, you can enjoy this little trip down recent memory lane back to Tuesday afternoon before we knew whatever it is we know now. All right, so with that context in mind, hello, Amy. How are you?
I am anxious, Patrick.
Me too.
I have massive amounts of anxiety. I am holding an empty coffee mug that's still warm because I have like a coffee warmer here. Because once my dad told me when I have anxiety to hold something warm, I swear to God, it was one of his things. My dad's a counselor, I should say. My dad is a counselor and works in this. And that was one of his things once when
and
he
it
was
works
like talking
for you.
Me down. Yeah, yeah. There's something about holding something warm. Shout out to Tom Board.
Nice. Okay.
My great. Coffee okay,
thing,
great.
Which is
okay,
a very great. Similar color for those of you who are not watching the video, which means nothing, is not warm. But I think the smell of coffee just makes me at least feel a little, I recognize it. So it makes me feel totally normal.
Okay. I'm actually planning to make more coffee after this. I've already had my two cups, which I normally allot. And it's just the day for it. It's the day. It's just
if there was a day to have a third cup of coffee, yeah, today qualifies as the day. So we got a lot of topics, a couple of really cool guests, but I want to start with calendars, Amy, because calendars are important. It's how we know today is November 3rd. We have a new calendar that is available for anyone who would like one. It is Believe Limited's Blood Feed calendar. For those who are not active on Facebook or Instagram, one of our properties, Blood Feed, has been putting out memes and other blood or BuzzFeed-esque content relative to our community for a number of years. Some of the posts, some of the memes, some of the characters have been particularly well-received, and so we thought it'd be really fun for 2021 to put some of the most popular memes and characters from our Blood Feed stream the last number of years into a 2021 calendar that includes all kinds of important bleeding disorders related dates of interest and some stickers to help you kind of customize it to your bleeding disorders needs. So we're pretty proud of it. It's totally free. It's available now, but it has to be ordered by November 20th. So you have between now and November 20th, you can sign up at believeltd.com/calendar. Again, believeltd.com/calendar, or you can follow the link in the program notes. I know Amy is going to be the first person to order one as soon as we wrap up today.
100%. Because there's several reasons why. Number one, it's like the highest, dumbest thing we've ever put out. Like, it's so great. Yes. I remember in the notes, like, choosing the memes that we were going to have for each month. Like, one of the very serious notes of our team was like, well, we have to have at least one cat. Like, it's not... We have to have one cat meme, which just made me laugh because it was like, you're right. We can't put out this calendar without one cat meme. In the midst of
like a bunch of notes. Yeah, trying to like really get into like, what are we missing? What do we need more of? And then it's like, a cat meme. Like,
yeah. And it was like, well, for sure. Like, we can't not put something out without a cat meme. Good Lord. And then the second thing that I loved, and you mentioned it, that you can customize it. There's going to be stickers with this. And it's free, by the way, a free calendar, y'all. Free, where like the stickers are like infusion days, like high dose or low dose days, your HTC visit. There'll be stickers of like when your local walk is, when the big conferences are nationally. So it's a really cool calendar that will, you know, help you and your family as you go through this crazy, you know, virtual time, in particular with your bleeding disorder at home.
And, you know, for some families, too, especially if you've got more than one bleeder like me in the crew, maybe this is the calendar that you want just for medical stuff. Like, yeah, when you put down the different, like, infusions or take this or do this or self-care. Like, maybe this is just that. And it's not a bad idea because it is kind of a silly, lighthearted calendar. So if you have to kind of engage with your medical stuff and it's not your favorite thing to do, well, at least if you have it logged in a calendar like this, it might make you chuckle once in a while. So bleedltd.com/calendar, and Amy's right, this is free, totally free. Okay, so that's the calendar. Moving on to NHF recently hosted this virtual insurance and reimbursement conference with the subtitle Access During Uncertain Times, which was held October 26th through the 29th and had 192 hemophilia treatment center social workers, nurses, and chapter leaders from 41 states who took part in this. The conference... The focus of it, rather, was understanding the impact that the current pandemic has had on patient access to care and the broad regulatory and administrative changes regarding insurance and reimbursement. So some, you know, dry but critically important stuff. Amy, given your experience and background in nonprofits, I have some questions for you about this conference. But before I get into them, I want to remind listeners that the Bloodstream podcast is made possible by our presenting sponsor, Takeda. With a rich history in hemophilia and bleeding disorders, Takeda wants patients and families to know that they are with them every step of the journey. And on their website, bleedingdisorders.com, you can find information, resources, and support for patients, caregivers, and families affected by bleeding disorders, including hemophilia A, hemophilia B, von Willebrand disease, as well as for those who have developed inhibitors to their factor treatment. Takeda is tireless in their pursuit of a world free of bleeds. They are committed to building upon the Baxalta and Shire legacy and believe that together we can continue to develop and deliver more innovative, transformative treatments for people living with bleeding disorders. And beyond delivering new treatments, Takeda is more dedicated than ever in their efforts to offer a wide range of programs and support to help patients through their treatment journey. Visit bleedingdisorders.com to learn more. That's bleedingdisorders.com. And hey, thanks to Takeda. All right, Amy, what can you tell us about this conference? What is it? And perhaps what from this year's is worth noting?
Yeah, this actually takes place every year. And I don't know how many years NHF has done this. It actually started just for social workers. And NHF started inviting chapter leadership, you know, in the last four years, something like that. As most people know, and maybe some people don't, the social workers that are in our community that work at our HTCs, I would say the bulk of their job is insurance access issues. They are tasked with finding resources for patients and also finding, you know, access, you know, windows to try to get treatment, to try to get care. And so this conference in particular is about what's happening nationally and also what's happening at a state level to give social workers and chapter leaders a foundation and a book of information to help patients truly get access to their treatment and their care. And it's a, when I was a executive director, it was my favorite conference of the year.
Really?
Some people
Why?
Didn't agree with me. Well, I was nerdy into this stuff because it felt like of all the things that I did in my job, There was like three pillars that I felt like actually changed or meant something to a patient's life, and insurance and helping people get access to care was kind of like the number one thing. I felt like I was actually contributing. And so any tool that would help me to navigate the system better or to understand or even to be better informed when I went into very, you know, fancy meetings at my state level, you know, like yeah, I would sure. have an arsenal with me that I could actually be useful in that meeting, and that helped a lot. So it's a great conference, and it's funny because it happens a lot, and I think it's one of those things that happens behind the scenes that our national organization really tries to educate and prepare HTC individuals and chapter individuals to actually go and do the work in the field. It's one of the things that NHF does that's really behind the scenes. I think sometimes right. when we think like, what in the world are these big organizations doing? This is one of those things. And I think it's right. extremely useful and wonderful. And I just to plug a little bit, next week we're going to have one of NHF's long-term lobbyists. Joe is going to be with us to talk about election results. And one of the policy directors at NHF, Nathan Schaefer, is going to be with us as well to kind of discuss election results, what it means for the new or existing administration coming in, and in particular, what was discussed at this conference. I think there was a lot of ground laid there in terms of where some of our initiatives, our federal bills are going, and also what's happening on the state level. So anyway, check in next week. It's going to be a great episode. And Joe and Nate are two people that work like in this policy wonk world, but they have the ability to disseminate the information in ways that like normal folks like us can really understand and engage with and kind of see where we fit into the puzzle. So, and they're also terrific people. They are funny.
That helps.
And I enjoy them. So anyway, that's kind of my
great
spiel. All right.
Well, thank you for that little look, like you said, a look behind the curtain at something that NHF does that doesn't get a whole lot of notice, but is critically important. And we'll hear from Joe and Nate next week about that, as well as policy stuff in general, which leads me to say, Amy, you have a conversation coming up here in just a little bit with Norbese from Black Women for Wellness, that also, she's the program manager and the policy director of that organization. For those who might not remember, Believe 19 interviews such as this, we started doing this after Juneteenth this year in honor of other organizations that we believed in. Believe Limited made donations to 19 different organizations and invited members of their leadership to sit down with either Amy or I for interviews that we would play here on Bloodstream. So Norbese and Black Women for Wellness, that was one of the people and organizations that we wanted to feature. And Amy spoke with Norbese just recently. So Amy, we're going to hear that in a little while, but what can you tell us about that conversation with Norbese?
Oh my gosh, it was one of my favorites. I think, you know, I'm not a policy wonk, but I'm definitely a policy nerd. I love it. And I love the people that do the work on the ground. And Norbese is one of those people that like does the work on the ground. And their work here in California, they have two locations actually. But they go about, and we'll get into it in the interview, but they go about reproductive health in a very different way. It's not linear like normally you hear policy work in terms of reproductive health and, you know, really serving their community of Black women here in California. And it's great. And she actually works, they have a, they're a 501c3, so they're a nonprofit organization, but they also have adjoining C4, which is basically their lobbying arm, which is a separate organization, separate financials, that she actually works out of doing the policy work there, which is really cool. So you kind of hear that structure and hear what she does in terms of, you know, blending her program work with the policy work. And cool. Anyway, she's very cool. And obviously, she's a policy person. She's well-spoken. And it's a great interview, great organization as you're thinking about end-of-the-year giving and kind of making your plans about, you know, what organizations, what missions do you want to serve, what communities you want to serve. It's another, you know, kind of door opening into another organization that we find really great.
Yeah, for sure. And a very local organization, a grassroots organization doing very direct work. So I know sometimes I can ask myself, where's my money going? Is it going to some, you know, big multinational organization? Yes. It's all going to overhead and salaries. And is it making a real difference? And first of all, those criticisms aren't totally fair. We'll break that down another time. But this is a grassroots organization. So great point, Amy. If you're looking for Giving Tuesday or just end of year giving, if you're looking for an organization worthy of support, Black Women for Wellness is certainly that. And you'll hear a bit more about them momentarily. Before we get into that, we have another voice we're going to hear from. And I actually want to invite our producer, Greg, to join us for a little bit here to talk about how we came to feature this audio from the Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Brett Gerwah. Not every day you get somebody like that on the podcast, is it, Amy?
I've been like chomping the bit to like talk about it here. And Admiral? Like what? I oh my gosh. And I also feel terrible, like I didn't know this was happening. So this is great, everybody. The podcast came out on Friday, so you can listen to it. It's the best get. I can't wait to hear the whole story.
So we should clarify, what Amy's referring to that came out last Friday was an episode of Cheat Codes, the Sickle Cell podcast that featured the Admiral. And it was a great discussion, and he is a fascinating person. So we thought it'd be really lovely to share a bit of that here on Bloodstream. So Greg, maybe if you can share with us a little bit of how we came to be having the Admiral on one of our shows and what we're going to hear from him in just a moment here.
Well, as you said in the intro, he's one of the busiest people in America. He's the second most important person in health and human services in the country. Not only is he an advisor to the coronavirus task force, but he's also leading the nation's efforts in the fight against opioids. So to say the least, he was very difficult to get on. But with the reputation of our doctors and our show, Amar and Mike were able to get their foot in the door. And then with a month of persuasion with his own secretary, his own assistant, we finally made it happen. And now he's interested in coming on monthly, it looks like.
He implied
at the end of the episode that he wants to do this again next month. So
fantastic. Wow, that's great to hear. So we'll play a clip now, and then people can check out the Cheat Codes podcast with Drs. Amar Zaidi and Mike Callahan. Link in the program notes or bloodstreammedia.com. What are we going to hear here in this short clip, Greg?
I would say a combination of critique and healthy optimism in terms of the way that our country has historically approached sickle cell disease. But in the last couple of years since he's been in office, since 2018, his personal efforts to improve the care of sickle cell patients in the country and worldwide. And it's a heightened priority in the healthcare in our country.
Well, let's give the clip a listen. This is from the Cheat Codes podcast with Admiral Brett Gerwah.
What you have accomplished in the last 4 years for sickle cell disease has been more than has been done in ever.
And well, we are not satisfied, let me tell you. We have a long way to go. I think we've got momentum. We've got some better data systems. For the first time, I'm so pleased that CMS was able to pull the data on sickle cell patients for everybody on Medicaid and CHIP. We've never had that before. Now that we have the data, but it's really ugly. The care that people receive is really not the standard that you give. It's not even close to the standard you give. So we have that work to do. I really want to work on systems of care. You know, we've had a sickle cell demonstration treatment project at HRSA for 14 years with the same $4 million of funding. That should be $40 or $400 million because it works. We just need to do that. And I think, you know, we also, we don't want to neglect our brothers and sisters around the world. And just by a little work in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, we can have the realistic opportunity just by newborn screening, pneumococcal vaccine and penicillin to save 9 million children by 2050. So we have a long way to go, but I want to be with you in getting there, whether I'm in uniform or not. You know, we have a long way to go, but we're going to get there together.
All right, once again, that was Admiral Brett Gerwah, the Secretary, Assistant Secretary for Health, and as Greg put it, the second most important person at the HHS in the United States of America. We greatly appreciate his time, and having him on Cheat Codes and getting to share a little bit of that here was pretty cool, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, it was doubly cool. We got to hear from Greg, and we got to hear from an Admiral.
I know, what a day. What a day.
Well, best day.
Yeah, so thank you, Greg, for setting that up for us and for making that interview happen.
Let me just say that pardon the hood, it is freezing here in Philly. I have a fire going. The heat is busted in my very old house that I'm with my parents right now. Our pipes busted because we turned on the heat, so we have no heat. So I've got a fire, I've got a sweatshirt, I've got a hood. So pardon the grizzly look.
I was going to say, you got the full beard, the hoodie. You do have a very bundled thing going on right now.
I thought it was regardless of the heat problems, I was like, that's a producer coming on to just give, an anecdote. I loved it. Thought it was appropriate.
She thought there was actual casting and costume decisions made there, but that was just Greg living his best life and popping on for a minute. That's all that was. All right. So, again, thank you to the Cheat Codes guys for making that happen and sharing that audio with us. So let's get into our final bit here before we go to your interview with Norbese, Amy. And that's on our story here on ICER publishing this evidence report on therapies for hemophilia A. So we want to break this down a little bit before we get into a bit of discussion. So who is ICER and what do they do? So ICER is an organization that was founded in 2006. ICER stands for the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. Interesting, Clinical and Economic Review. And it's an independent and nonpartisan research organization that objectively evaluates the clinical and economic value of prescription drugs, medical tests, and other healthcare and healthcare delivery innovations. Today, and this comes directly from their website, I should mention, ICER is best known as the nation's independent watchdog on drug pricing. What's the purpose of this particular report? So the report that was just released at the end of or middle of last month in October was to assess the comparative clinical effectiveness and value of, I'm not going to get the pronunciation right, Valotocogene roxaparvovec. That's not even close. So we're just going to go with Valrox. How's that, Amy? Does that work for you?
That sounds even better.
Going to go with Valrox and emicizumab, commercially known as Hemlibra, for the treatment of hemophilia A. So just to repeat, what this report was doing was comparing the clinical effectiveness and value of Valrox and emicizumab for the treatment of hemophilia A. So I'll leave that there. And Amy, what were some of the findings that ICER's report published, and what does all of this mean?
Well, and this is taken from NHF's website. If you guys go to hemophilia.org, you can get a review of, a short review, actually, of this massive report. The report was pages and pages and pages long with lots of graphs and things, and it was very confusing to normal humans like myself. But basically, from NHF's website, they individually compared emicizumab and Valrox to prophylactic treatment with clotting factor, and they were looking at not only the clinical effectiveness, as Patrick said, but the value, basically the cost. So for how much money that the system will spend on a treatment, is their clinical value and lifestyle value to patients. And the findings was that emicizumab reduced cost and produced equal or substantial net health benefits for people with hemophilia A. And in their assessment of Valrox, which of course is not on the market yet, they used the placeholder price of $2.5 million. And at this price, when compared to prophy, ICER found that Valrox would also be a cost savings, but given the ongoing clinical trial and the evidence of health benefit was deemed promising but inconclusive. So they couldn't, the report actually say that it would be a health benefit to that cost quite yet because of the data, which makes sense.
Yeah, it makes total sense. It states here in the report, given the lack of head-to-head trials, along with the uncertainty about Valrox described above, as Amy just referenced, the evidence is currently, quote, insufficient to compare Valrox to emicizumab as treatments for adults with hemophilia A without inhibitors. So They kind of lay out the cases for each, but of course the big asterisk on the whole thing is that they're with Valrox and gene therapy, we're looking at a treatment that is still in the investigational phase. It is still in clinical trials. We know all about investigational clinical trials from it's in the Genes podcast hosted by Amy Board, bloodstreammedia.com. It's in the Genes. So it's not apples to apples to compare something like emicizumab to Valrox at this particular point, is it, Amy?
No, not yet. Not
so why
yet.
Do you think we were, what, if you had to guess, now we're guessing, we don't know, this is just people guessing, but why do you think they were doing this analysis, ICER, at this particular time, given that emicizumab has been on the market now for a couple of years and Valrox is not out of clinical trials? Why now?
Well, I think, you know, obviously we're heading into this paradigm shift in hemophilia treatment, and it's been, you know, foreseen for multiple years that this was going to happen. So this report, I believe, started 5 years ago, and in particular with these two treatments. And I think, and I'm just saying this right now, I have no idea, this is not based in fact, this is just my opinion of the situation, is that this report came out right when we thought the BioMarin's Valrox would be approved, yeah, and it would be, you know, like out in the market, and we would have to talk about these things. I think, you know, in particular with hemophilia, we are such a high cost community to the overall health system, kinda. You know, when I there's so few of us, that I think other costs, you know, skyrocket in comparison. There's just so many more people who have rheumatoid arthritis, per se, sure, with high cost drugs. But we are in our own very expensive. So one hemophilia A patient on an insurance plan can, you know, create imbalance, you know, with all of those, right, tricky numbers. So to have any type of data about overall cost to the system is very, very important. The big, I mean, we're all talking about it with gene therapy, but, you know, where they set that price point is going to determine how much access patients truly can have. I think one of the things about ME is that the price point was in the sweet spot that insurers are really saying, yes, this is a cost-effective way to manage not only hemophilia A with inhibitors, but also hemophilia A patients. So it'll be interesting to follow this. And both NHF and HFA have a pretty firm stance that the lifestyle of the patient and the physician recommendation should dictate what is prescribed and what patients should have access to. And, you know, we are entering this new world for hemophilia A and hemophilia B patients that, depending on your lifestyle, you really can have a choice in your treatment options of what you want to do, which is life-giving. I just think it's, yes, so incredible. And so this is just another step in that. And I think it's fascinating. And I just want to mention that there was a public forum. ICER does this. They put out reports and then they have these public forums. It's a thing. And we will get that report. They will, you know, type up what that public forum was about. We'll get that to you. But it was brought to our attention that the public forum was happening by a patient to you, Patrick, yeah, which I just think is interesting. This community is so engaged. So yeah, engaged.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
So to Amy's point, it happened on October 30th. That report will be published. And when it is, we'll provide an update here. And yes, the community is very engaged and very eager to see the decisions that will be made around pricing for gene therapy, because that has been a big question for a long time. I want to echo something that you mentioned about the individualized care for patients and how having different options enables that individual care to happen. Sanji Wilkes, who's the Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Hemophilia Federation of America, she responded to the review with the following statement, quote, "The choice of treatment for each person with hemophilia needs to be individualized, patient-centric, accessible, and affordable." I like that list. Individualized, patient-centric, accessible, and affordable. The full range of products, clotting factor, non-factor therapies, and eventually gene therapies, must be available for patients working in consultation with their doctors to develop treatment plans that best preserve their health and quality of life. Can't say it much better than that. And that's kind of the bottom line of all this. So I align with you, Amy. My gut is that this was intended to come to fruition, this report and the subsequent public hearing, on the heels of an anticipated approval of Valrox, or in the event of having the first gene therapy for hemophilia on the market, perhaps this was looked at as the first post-launch, quote-unquote, round table of sorts, bringing the right thought leaders and experts together to try to get arms around what do we do here. The timing's just a bit off, and so, you know, I walk away from this. I will say this. You know what my biggest takeaway actually from this is, in all honesty, and this is just, again, me personally?
Mm-hmm.
Emicizumab comes out quite well. You know, there's been enough like scuttlebutt from a certain number of people who have been skeptical of Hemlibra or skeptical of the data that's been shared or data that has not been shared. And, you know, this to me is just like the most recent credible indication that Hemlibra's doing some pretty great things for this community. So I feel like that's a little bit of a low-key takeaway from this report.
I agree. I think the benefit that it provides to patients with a cost savings measure, like for the system in general, is really promising. I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
And I want to say that this is the information that we're talking about. Not scientifically. We're just, you know, two people commenting on it. This is all accessible to you. You can download this report like a normal human, and you can also kind of follow these things. You can also get on their ICER's email server and join these public forums at any time. We'll put that information in the program notes for you. But some of the names that are involved in the creation of the report, and also members of ICER's board and kind of the panel discussion that was leading this, are all names that, not all, but there are names that we know in the hemophilia community, people that are involved with us extensively, like Dr. Stephen Pipe, Mark Skinner is involved. It is heavy relied upon on all stakeholders of this community. That's kind of how this organization works. So very accessible. And if there's interest, I think maybe we can get one of those members here on the podcast to kind of discuss further, because I do believe that the work is not done, obviously. I mean, you know, that's what's happening with gene therapies right now. We need more data. And so this report just highlighted that as well, that the net benefit to patients, the health benefit to patients, is still something that is being worked out. So this is just, I think, the beginning of this conversation, and we will have more of these.
And fortunately, being worked out with consideration of the patient voice, which is something that you mentioned, Mark Skinner. There's a quote from him in NHF's summary of the report, and with that includes comments. And Mark says in his quote, "We appreciate ICER's increasing efforts to engage and include patients directly in its review process, and recognize that our work is not done. Enhancing the patient voice is vital. If patient advocacy groups, providers, manufacturers, payers, and policymakers are to find common ground and ensure high-value therapies remain within reach of patients." So there you go. And kudos to ICER for, to Mark's point, increasing their efforts. I'm unaware of these, but I take it at face value here, and I agree with him. It's extremely important. So to see his name, Sunji is a parent. She knows the community as well as anybody. Brian O'Mahony from Ireland, former president of the WFH, also a patient involved in this, and many other panels like it. So we are well represented, and we got to keep underscoring the importance of that patient-centric focus and inclusion of the patient voice in these processes. So again, this is all from ICER. It is their evaluation on hemophilia A therapies. There'll be links in the program notes, or you can Google to find more. And once the report is published, we'll see about getting one of the significant folks to come on and speak with us about that.
And I will say, if you're feeling isolated at home, if you have thoughts, if you have concerns, those types of things, if you feel like you are not, your voice is not being heard, these bigger organizations, these advocacy organizations like NHF, your local chapter, HFA, these are the places that represent our community at these big levels in terms of like stakeholder involvement. And so reach out to them. NHF, for the, you know, in a huge initiative, is trying to get patient voice kind of wrangled, almost in a way. They are opening, and they have an invitation for patient voice. So this is the time to do it. So I just encourage listeners, if you feel that you haven't been heard, that truly is a place to go.
Agreed. All right. We will take a quick break. And when we come back, Amy's interview with Norbese Flint, the policy director and program manager of Black Women for Wellness.
I am here with Norbese Flint. She is the program manager and the policy director for Black Women for Wellness. Norbese, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited.
Yay, I am too. Tell me a little bit about the organization, how you got involved, what the mission is, what you guys do, and your work with the community.
Yeah, so Black Women for Wellness, we are a nonprofit committed to the empowerment, health, and well-being of Black women and girls. We are located in South Los Angeles and been around since 1997, and we're a reproductive justice organization. And so I'll pause here for to talk about like what is reproductive justice, because like that's a term that is used and sometimes interchanged with reproductive health and rights. And reproductive justice is actually a particular theology framework that looks at how everything that has to do with having a child, not having a child, and being able to raise your family with dignity and respect. So it goes beyond the reproductive health and rights framework and looks at like intersectional issues like environment, like race and class, like economics and education, right? And it was a combination of the social justice and reproductive rights movement. And so it's a framework that we use in our work that we go beyond just the traditional reproductive and sexual health, even though that's central to our work, but we're looking at toxic chemicals in beauty and consumer products and how that impacts our health. We're looking at sexual harassment and what that does with young people and have a whole program on it. We do a robust civic engagement program where we turn out people to vote. And my job is the policy work that's looking at structures and thinking about what type of obstacles and barriers are in place that are causing disparities and inequities, and how do we remove them. And so our focus is more on thinking about how do we make society in ways and dreams and reimagine a society in a way that can have everybody live their best lives, right? And like focus on those structures rather than trying to focus on like behavioral changes and our like individual changes, right? And so that's kind of the crust of our work. We do have two other programs around food justice. And doing a lot of work around movement and some direct service stuff since COVID-19 has happened. So what we used to do where we had a cooking class that we used to do in person, we now just give away food every Thursday to the community and make sure that we're giving like organic plant-based foods. Because a lot of times when there's food giveaways, people give like pretty high carb dry foods. And we're wanting to make sure that people are staying healthy and things like that. And so that's kind of Black Women for Wellness in like the 5 second or short space. We also have a C4, which I run. So that does our political work, which is Black Women for Wellness Action Project. So that is really active right now.
I bet. And can you explain to our listeners the difference between a 501c3 and a 501c4?
Yes. So most people only really care about this if you work for the IRS. But
fair.
But it's super important for us as organizations. So a 501c3 is your usual nonprofit organization that one of the crests of being a nonprofit 501c3, which is a charitable organization, is that you are nonpartisan, right? And so it is a lot of the social work and social welfare work that comes out of the 501c3s. 501c4 is an interesting amalgamation of like a PAC and a C3, where the vast majority of your work needs to be still social welfare work, But the C4 actually lets you to do some political work, right? So on the C4 side, we're able to like say, you know, these elected officials are being really good for our communities. We need to go out there and vote for them. And these are not so much, and we should get them out of office. And so the C4 gives us another tool for us to hold our leaders accountable and also engage in the reimagining in a different way.
Mm. In your policy work, in those conversations, tell me a little bit about the unique voice that you in particular and your organization has. I'm sure my guess would be that the conversation isn't robust in reproductive justice. It's kind of, you know, reproductive health, very bland. How can we do this black and white? What is your unique voice and your advocacy work in particular for Black young women and girls?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So Black Women for Wellness and Black Women for Wellness Action Project. So BWW is the only Black statewide Black Women's RJ organization in California. And Black Women for Wellness Action Project was the first 501c4 Black Women's Reproductive Justice. So we're the only one in California as well. So we stand in a space by ourselves quite often. But what we do with our work, and particularly our policy work, is really, again, I'm going to keep using this word reimagine a lot, but we're really looking at reimagining what the future is. And so a lot of times when conversations are happening around policy, Black women are just not thought about, right? We vote in high numbers. Of course, there's a place for us to improve in our votes, but there's actual research that shows that we are the least thought about when it comes to making political decisions. And so when it comes to policy, our job, or my job in particular, is to make sure that when we are crafting policy, writing policy, thinking about what is important enough to pass legislation on, that we are bringing Black women and girls to the table. And we know that when we bring Black women and girls to the table, that helps everyone. And so being very like centered on that and thinking and pushing us to dream bigger instead of having small fixes, right? So what does it look like for us to go and move upstream in some of the work that we're looking at? And thinking about how barriers are causing issues, or how institutionalized racism, or classism, or patriarchy is causing barriers for people to live their best lives. So a tangible example, we wrote a bill last year that required implicit bias training and explicit bias training for all perinatal providers, specifically looking at and wanting to close the gap between Black women and Indigenous women and everybody else when it comes to maternal mortality and morbidity, as well as infant mortality and morbidity. And like we were the ones who are like, we need to do something on this. And we need something that's targeted to Black women, right? Because California has made all the kind of strives to kind of reduce maternal mortality in general, but that gap of 3 to 4 times Black women are more likely to die was still there, which means that we needed to have a targeted thought process of how and what we are doing to address the issues that are contributing to Black women dying. And so we wrote that, we put in and we updated the collection standards of data collection around mortality and morbidity to international standards and got it passed. And so it's in law now. And so those are the kinds of conversations that we're having of like, how do we make sure that we are addressing communities that are very often overlooked in the policy process?
Programmatically, one of the things that struck me as I was doing like, you know, a very nerdy deep dive into the organization yesterday and today was your programmatic work with girls in particular. about understanding sexual violence and harassment and actually understanding it and noticing and being aware when it happens. And I just wonder, like, what is your philosophy? What is the organization's philosophy in teaching that and growing that awareness and building that empowerment for those girls in particular?
Yeah, that's a super interesting way in which that program came about. This is under our Get Smart Before You Get Sexy program.
First of all, best program name ever. Right. Get Smart Before You Get Sexy. It kind of brought tears to my eyes. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it was very good. Anyway, continue.
Yes, we're very proud of that name. but it's and this was our traditional like reproductive and sexual health work that we went in and had conversations about how to protect yourself from STDs and how to protect yourself from unintended pregnancies. And like we were in the schools and the young folks came to us and was just like, yo, this is all cool and all, but like, can we talk about sexual harassment? And we're like, okay. Right. And this is before like the Me Too movement, before a lot of stuff became popularized. And they're just like, yo, we can't go anywhere without being yelled at, touched, all these things. We can't leave our school. We can't walk. We're getting grabbed at all the time. And we want to know what to do about it because like when we, and this is mostly girls of color, Black and brown girls, we're like, when we talk to people about it, people ignore us. They don't care. And then when we try to defend ourselves, then we get kicked out of school. Right. And so they're like, we want to have this conversation. And we're like, hell yes, let's figure out how to have this conversation. And that started like a mini program called Step Forward within our Get Smart, where we explore sexual harassment, but also the culture of violence and consent. We did focus groups, conversations with folks, with young people, just to get like what they're learning, what they're not learning, and how do we engage in conversations about sexual harassment. And then on a policy level or a school level, we're talking with administrators, we're talking with Title IX providers or Title IX folks, we're talking with other people and elected officials and school board members about how do we make sure that girls of color are not getting the short end of the stick when it comes to sexual harassment and also doing it in ways that are restorative, right? Because we don't want to continue criminalizing folks, right? Mm-hmm. But we want to make sure that people understand what sexual harassment is and how detrimental it can be to a young person's life when they can't focus on school because somebody is like touching them inappropriately or calling them names and and nobody is coming to their rescue. Mm.
Do that particular program, do you have boys involved? Are boys a part of the education?
Yes. And so at first we had it targeted to like to girls and gender nonconforming folks. And then when we had a focus group with the young men, we were kind of floored because like the girls in particular and the gender nonconforming folks knew everything about consent, like what it was, all the things, how to protect themselves. And when we talked to the boys, they didn't. And it was just like we had put all the onus on women and girls and young folks or young girls particularly to like defend themselves, to know about consent, to know about like rape culture, to know about all these things, and have been ignoring those conversations with the guys. And so we intentionally were like, yo, we want to have these conversations and also know why we are having these conversations with guys. They had once a lot of questions about like reproductive and sexual health. They also had a lot of conversations about being pressured in their identity, being caught up in like their sexuality and their quote unquote manliness, right? And how it gets reinforced. And so how performative a lot of the things that they were doing, which didn't come from heart, but in this ideas of what it means to be seen. And so that came to like a real core part of our work. So we expanded to all genders to have these conversations and make sure we're being inclusive but not leaving folks out. And we know because people talk and work and be in relationship with people that we can't just focus on one group of people.
Right. To kind of wrap it up, what you mentioned that you guys are doing a pretty extensive, you know, making sure everyone's registered to vote. But what is policy-wise, what are you guys looking at right now? How does your particular unique line of work kind of fit in with this larger civil rights, you know, movement momentum that's happening right now?
Yeah, so it was a tough legislative year in California. We started off with like 6 bills and then like COVID hit and we had to reduce our package down to 3. And most people had to drop down to 1 or 2 bills. And so it was crazy. I think a lot of folks saw how like we just ran out of time in the legislature. And so some bills didn't even come up to vote. And then Buffy Wicks, our assembly member from the Bay Area, had to come in with her newborn baby to make a vote. It was wild. And so all to say is we're looking at a really tough policy year actually moving forward. One, because we want to pick up all the things that we dropped off this year in terms of doula coverage for folks, both for private and public insurance, looking at how we address environmental issues and climate change, doubling down on toxins, and also looking at what does it mean to be and start an innovative solutions, or what I call an Apollo program, to ending racism in the state, right? And so doing all the work and coming out with the creative ways in which we can dismantle racism and racial structures that we know are created. And so we're looking to push all of that for next year, but we're also doing that with the backdrop of somewhere between 10 to 25% budget cuts that are coming in because of the crisis of this year. And also with no real federal help looking on the horizon. And so we know some of those budget cuts are actually going to be triggered in coming up this fall. And we know it's going to be even worse next year. And so we also know that we're going to have to protect a lot of the social networks and things that have been in place to protect folks really hard next year because we know that there's going to be budget cuts and they're going to be pretty, pretty awful.
How can, and I'm just going to out myself, how can I nerdily follow like what you guys are doing in the legislative season and like the ups and downs? Where can we follow you guys? Is there social media chatter, websites? How can we follow you guys?
Yeah, so definitely check us out on Facebook and Instagram, both Black Women for Wellness and Black Women for Wellness Action Project. You can put it in. I think it's like BWW4W. Don't quote me, LA. But if you put
we'll
Black
put
Women
in the
for Wellness, yeah,
I'll
if you put work. Black Women for Wellness, you'll find us. We're on Twitter as well. You can always sign up for our newsletters that we put out information once a week about what we're doing. We post some of our stuff on the website. I mean, the quickest way to get in touch with us though is probably through like the Instagram or Facebook. But we'll put all that information there and, love for folks to like volunteer, love for folks to like get involved, particularly, as we like are in election season. So we're doing a ton of different stuff around hosting virtual parties and stuff like that. So please get involved.
Oh, cool. I love it. Where are you located in California?
We have 2 offices. We have 1 in Leimert Park in Los Angeles, and then we have another one in Stockton, California.
So. Cool. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Norbese, for spending some time with Amy and letting us and our listeners know about what's going on at Black Women for Wellness. As we spoke about earlier, if you are looking for an organization to support, whether it's for Giving Tuesday or just end of the year feel goods, Black Women for Wellness is an organization that we believe should be on your list. There are links in the program notes to learn more. And with that, that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited who makes this Bloodstream podcast possible. Thanks to our guests, Norbese Flint from Black Women for Wellness and the Assistant Secretary of Health, Admiral Brett Jawah, for joining us on this episode. Thanks as well to our presenting sponsor, Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, to learn more about their resources and commitment. Subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. I'll give recommendations such as Apple, Spotify, SoundCloud. You can subscribe to all of them. That's the new CTA. Subscribe to all of them. Leave us a rating in the Apple Store. We prefer 5 stars. 4 stars are acceptable. You know how I feel about 3. Share this episode with a friend or any episode with anyone. Word of mouth is literally the best way we reach new people. And if there's topics that you want to hear more about, email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. We've got you covered. If you'd like to be involved in an upcoming Bloodstream narrative or docu-styled podcast series, we've pretty much always got one that we're casting. Let us know, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You can connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. You'll find Bloodstream Media on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter. Or you can follow Amy Board or Patrick James Lynch on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram, or LinkedIn. Shout out to all the LinkedIn users out there. Check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links and information related to the stories and segments featured on this episode. I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I am that other host, Amy Board.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.